Well, I'm delighted to be back here today, and my good friend Barry asked me to come and share with you some of my experiences and my perspective about something that's very close to my heart, which is the Middle East and the conflict that's going on there, most specifically the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And it's been a little bit daunting, I have to admit, to try to prepare this for today. It's a little like trying to take a thimble to the ocean and figure out exactly where to put it, to dip into something that's so deep and immensely complicated and just inexhaustible as a subject. I put together a little handout that I'm going to have on the back table when you leave that's got some terminology for the Middle East conflict that I think is helpful. And the best part is there's scriptural concepts on the back from the three religions in the area, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, that address peace and reconciliation and forgiveness. So that's a pretty neat little thing to have. What I want to do is to try to shine some light on this subject. Are we fixing that? Shine some light on the subject, what's happening there, what I consider to be the spiritual answer or antidote to what's happening there, and what we can each learn from that situation and how we can all participate in a healing of what's going on there, no matter where we live. So my background in the Middle East, it's a good question. How did a girl from sleepy little Forest Grove, Oregon, end up hanging out in one of the most violent, conflictual regions on the planet? I think my mom would like to know the answer to that one, too. I've gone over 25 trips. I've kind of lost track of the time now and the number. And it's only been 10 years, Barry. You're making me much older.
Oh,
yeah, 25 years, I would have been pretty young.
But
it feels like it sometimes. And I like the way he says I commute there, because that's really what it feels like sometimes. And I do spend about 2 months a year there. And from the first time I was there, I just felt something really catch hold of my heart. And the people and the cultures and the spiritual depth and wisdom and history that's there. And I just knew that I was called to spend time there, be there, work there somehow, and just do whatever I could to help shift things. So I've led some spiritual pilgrimage tours there. That's one of the things I enjoy doing, is taking people to just richly experience the three traditions and the culture. And I do what I would call informal diplomacy. When I'm there, my goals are breaking down stereotypes and gently but very persistently challenging the dominant, conflictual, problematic paradigms and ways of thinking. Just chip, chip, chip away. I like to build bridges between people, and I have introduced many Jews to their first Arab and many Arabs to their first Jew, and that's always quite an experience for me. And one of the things I do when I'm there is something we can do anywhere, which is to greet each person that I encounter with a respect and a reverence and reflect to them their inherent value. Because in areas of conflict or darkness, that's often really missing, and people internalize that sense of not mattering. When I'm there, it's a little bit like standing in the midst of a tidal wave. The energy there of conflict and fear is so strong that if you're holding a different paradigm, it's very much like you're trying to stand up as the wave is washing over you. And the way I describe my work sometimes is those ships that go through the ice fields to break up the ice for other ships. I feel like that's my job, but I have like an ice pick and a little tiny hammer. And I'm just there chipping away at what I can chip away at. I've been present around the calendar there because I go so often. So I've experienced all of the Jewish holidays, the Muslim holidays, the Christian holidays. And I'm adopted into a lot of families, so I've really gotten to be a part of a lot of those celebrations, and I've danced at Palestinian weddings, and I've been at bat mitzvahs and prayed the Shabbat Sabbath prayers with my Jewish friends. And I've also sat with people on all sides of this conflict, and we tend to think in terms of two sides, and there really are two major sides, but there's so much more than that. There's so many striations in each side. And I've listened to their stories, and I've heard their pain and their anguish and their hopes for the future. So Barry mentioned I'm an interfaith minister, a psychologist, and a systems analyst. And I think God really had something in mind there, because all of those things are really kind of necessary to be there and do what I do. I have a great respect for all wisdom traditions, and I like to look for the ideas that weave through them all, the truth that's in every single one of them, and yet celebrate the diversity of expression in the uniqueness of each one. And the psychology really helps, because when you're with wounded people, and there's no more wounded area really than that one, it helps to have that ability to sit with that great pain. It's not an easy thing to do. And understanding how everything relates at a systems level, when you tweak one part of a system, how it ripples out through, is very helpful to me as I try to unravel and make sense of what's going on so that I can be as helpful as possible. And God also kind of gave me a face that works there, is what I like to say. It's like, it's just funny to me, because wherever I am, I'm one of them, right? So if I'm with my Arab friends, everybody speaks Arabic to me, they think I'm an Arab. If I'm with my Jewish friends in the Jewish areas, they all speak Hebrew to me and they think I'm a Jew. So it opens a lot of doors, and it really just sets people at ease. So I don't believe in accidents. I think that was all part of the plan. It's one of the clues for me that I'm supposed to be there. I'm often asked if I'm afraid to go, because I do go during pretty difficult times. And what I can tell you is that I absolutely have no fear about being there, about going there. I feel just as safe walking down the streets there as I do in Seattle, maybe safer, right? And I've been sitting in a hotel room meditating and had someone assassinated down the hall from me while I was sitting there. I've heard suicide bombs go off. I've been in a spot and 24 hours later had a suicide bomb go off in that spot. So I like to say that I sort of walk between the raindrops there. I just feel like I'm protected and I'm supposed to be there. And there's no guarantees. I'm not saying nothing would ever happen to me, but those things to me are messages from spirit that I'm doing my work and I'm where I'm supposed to be. Mom probably didn't know some of that, sorry. So another question that I'm often asked is, you know, what is it about this place? Why can't they stop? Why is it so violent? I mean, just constantly. And I mean, when we think about it, it's such a place of great spiritual light. The birthplace of the three monotheistic traditions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all started right there in that tiny little region of the world. These great prophets, Moses and Jesus and Muhammad and so many others, that's where they taught. That's where they were born and that's where they taught. And yet this just conflagration, this fire all the time. Well, here's my personal theory. My personal theory of part of what that's about is that it is an area of such incredible spiritual power. There's so much power there that anytime we have a lot of power or energy, it doesn't take very much of knocking it off course to have a really catastrophic, unpredictable result. So if we've got electricity, electricity is electricity, it's the power, but it can be used to light a great cathedral or to electrocute someone, right? It's how it's directed. And there's just so much power that just knocking it off course or directing it just a little bit off course just has amazingly huge results. So that's my personal theory of why there's a lot of upheaval there. Now, here in this country, a lot of us since September 11th especially have become aware of violence in the world in a whole new way, because that really brought it home to us in a way that previously we weren't that connected to. The rest of the world has been pretty familiar with that kind of thing for a long time. But now there's a lot of confusion and a lot of concern and bewilderment about the increasing and spreading violence coming from the Middle East, the anti-American sentiment that's on the rise really around the globe, but particularly in the Muslim and Arab communities, and the rise in terrorism across the world. And a lot of us have felt kind of afraid and vulnerable and powerless because nobody really understands what that's about. And unfortunately, the policies of the governments involved, ours included, you know, the things that we're doing, the solutions that we're trying to put forth, are based in the same fear and ignorance and arrogance that created the very things that we're trying to solve. And Einstein, we've all heard this one, about the significant problems of our time cannot be solved by the level of thinking or consciousness that created them. So we're sort of on this repetitive cycle. And the truth is, violence has never brought peace, and violence never will bring peace. So in the Middle East, on the human level, the conflict is so complicated. From a spiritual perspective, it's actually much simpler. There are some basic underlying issues that fuel and inform the manifestations of violence and conflict in the cycle that we see there. And it holds lessons for each and every one of us individually. It's a magnifier. What's going on there is like a magnified mirror being held up to each one of us. So the patterns there are so developed and so entrenched and so huge, it's sometimes hard to see how they apply to us in our own daily lives. But they're there, because they're not an island. We're all connected. We actually all are one. So the collective consciousness of the globe is manifesting in all of these different conflicts, including that one in the Middle East. So in consciousness is where the only true and lasting solution actually resides. But on a daily basis, each one of us can either be part of the problem ongoing or part of the solution. So when we talk about the conflict in the Middle East, if you remember one thing today, this is what I want you to remember. We're talking about the Jews and the Palestinians, who are Arabs. And both of these peoples have a deep, deep fear, terror actually, of being annihilated, of ceasing to exist. They feel that their very existence on the planet is threatened every day. And they're worried that their culture, their way of life, you know, there's no future for their children. They really are afraid of extinction. And that one thing, that one fear, is present in every moment that they live, and it directs their actions. And most of us in this room actually, thankfully, can't even begin to comprehend that level of fear. It also translates into a feeling of, I don't matter. No one cares about me. No one cares whether I live or die. Nobody cares if my people are here or not. So there's a real value issue of nobody cares about me. And then that fear. Those two things together really create all the stuff that we're seeing there. This endless cycle of retaliation and revenge. You hurt me, I'm going to hurt you. You threaten me, I'm going to threaten you back. So there's all that posturing. You took this from me, I'm taking that from you. The eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. And it's very rooted in primitive lower nature, survival, fight or flight. And there really is a seriously stuck energy around that. Now, us humans, sorry, I knew it was going to happen. We sometimes get very, very attached to our stories and our wounds and our history. And I actually believe it's one of the quintessential struggles for humanhood to have something happen to you, something potentially horrific, slavery, the Holocaust, being involved in a natural disaster like Katrina and losing everything, or something more personal, being abused in childhood in some way, or having a terrible addiction or overwhelming loss, but some kind of catastrophic occurrence. And how do you move on from that in a way that honors your past and learns the lessons of that event, and yet doesn't let it become so much a part of one's identity that we are poisoned by it and we can't go forward and have any kind of quality of life because we're so kind of poisoned by that event or that ongoing issue. I think that's one of our greatest challenges as humans, and it's definitely present there. There's a huge unhealed wound of the persecution, historic ongoing persecution of the Jewish people, and then we're seeing it now with the Palestinians with what they're going through. And it's also more complicated when it's continuing to happen. So it's very easy when we're in fear, this giant fear, to get into a very clear separation, us and them. They're different. They're my problem. If they would go away, if they would stop that, if they, then I would be okay. And in that region, we have things like physical walls being built to try to separate the two because there's such a belief in the us and them. And there are laws there, much like apartheid laws in South Africa, that work to divide the people so they can't actually get to know each other. I just am always astounded because it's like parallel universes. I go back and forth between these two parallel universes, and it's just like they're right next to each other, and they have no idea what's happening down the road. And the last thing I wanted to touch on that this fear creates that we're seeing there is this rise in fundamentalism that we've got going on globally. Like radical religious fundamentalism, and not just in Islam. It's also present and happening in Israel among some of the Jewish community as well. So the principle there is when we feel threatened, we retreat into rigidity. We get back into like yes and no and right and wrong and black and white because we're afraid. When we feel safe, we can be flexible and we can be tolerant. But when we're afraid, it becomes very clear that there are lines. So we're stuck in the Middle East in this incredibly strong, primitive fear. And you know what? We can't have fear and peace at the same time. They can't exist in the same moment. And the Course in Miracles teaches us that we always have a choice between love and fear. And that's what I would say, our spiritual antidote to fear is always going to be love. Love is the antidote to fear, not retaliatory attacks, but love. And love and fear also can't exist simultaneously at the same time. And we can heal that fear with love. But what does that actually mean? It sounds so good, and we can just love our enemies and love them into changing, and yet it's not that simple. We really have to take love into the world in order to affect this transformation that we're trying to have. There is nothing at all wrong with working on our consciousness and cultivating inner peace and cultivating a heart. In fact, that's all essential to the transformation that needs to happen on this planet. But love in action is what this world is crying out for and what the Middle East is crying out for at this time. People like Jesus and Gandhi and Martin Luther King didn't just sit in a cave and meditate to try to make the world a better place or a more peaceful place. They actually took their message out to the streets, went into the midst of the people, and demonstrated the principle of love in action. So what I wanted to do today was just give you the one practice that I have adopted for myself, which is actually quite simple, and it's truly what I do. When I go there, it's actually what I do every day, no matter where I am. But it's the way I've chosen to actually put feet under that prayer for peace and to actually do take my love out into the world. And it's based in the teachings of Jesus, fundamentally, and then also in the teachings of Gandhi and Martin Luther King with their nonviolent approach to changing the world. So it starts with the very familiar scripture of turning the other cheek, which I actually believe is one of the most misunderstood scriptures that we have, and a lot of people reject it out of hand because it seems like some sort of unattainable ideal that maybe Jesus could do that, but I can't. And it also has been interpreted a lot to mean, you know, if somebody hits you, let them hit you again. So there's like this belief that if I'm going to be a good Christian or if I'm going to follow the teachings of Jesus, I need to be a doormat and not ever stand up for myself. And that is so not what that scripture is about. It's so not what it's about. Jesus was all about liberating us from all kinds of oppression. And what that scripture actually, at its simplest level, teaches us is when something comes at us, an offense, a violent act, an insult, some sort of abuse, something negative, whatever it is, we're called to turn the better part of our nature towards that offender or that offense. It doesn't mean lay down or say, hit me again, or, you know, I like that. No, it's to turn the better part of our nature. It's an action. It's an active, not passive, response to what's coming at you. So that's fundamentally where I base my practice. And Gandhi and Martin Luther King took that idea, and the nonviolent approach to changing the world is anything but passive. People always call that pacifist. When I try to promote this, obviously, in the Middle East, and people are like, you know, they have the idea of it being passive and allowing someone to continue to hurt you. But what they taught was assertive nonviolence, stepping right into the middle of things and saying, you know, this is I'm going to present a different option here. So I took all of that and something that Maya Angelou said, which was this. She said that if we are sitting or with someone who makes a derogatory or destructive comment about a person or group of people, and it's easiest to think in terms of like a racial slur or a racial joke or something, if we sit with them and allow them to say that and remain silent, we have validated what they said with our silence. We basically have said we agree with them by remaining silent. And what her call was to make a stand lovingly, compassionately, but express a different opinion. You don't have to make the person bad or wrong for what they just said. You don't have to shame or humiliate them. You just need to clearly state that you don't agree and that you have a different idea. And that just struck me to the core when I heard it. And it really changed my life because it was like that day I thought, that's what I need to do. Because I heard a lot of that stuff. And it was just like, that's what I need to do. And then I took that with something that Nelson Mandela said, which was, no one can hear you if they feel threatened by you. If someone perceives that you are a threat to them, they cannot hear what you're saying. They're focused on way different priorities. So I always have this goal of not doing that, of trying to set people at ease and not shaming or humiliating or publicly embarrassing them, but trying to do it as lovingly, gently, and kindly as I can. Now, God made this pretty easy for me in one sense, in that I have friends in just about every ethnic group and religious group on the planet. So whenever anybody says anything negative or slanderous or jokes, it's like my friends' faces come right into my mind. And it's as though they're with me, listening. And I feel what I think they would feel if they heard that. So in that sense, it's pretty easy for me to stand up for them in that moment. Now, this has put me into some pretty interesting situations in my life, because I've done this a lot now. I call it doing my thing. And I want to tell you a couple of stories, two stories. One of them happened with an Egyptian teenage girl in an airport in Egypt. And I was with the tour group, and I was sitting there, and she was across from me, and we started a conversation. And she noticed I had on a necklace that was in Arabic, and it had my name in Arabic. And she asked me about it, and I told her a Palestinian friend of mine had given it to me. And when she heard the word Palestinian, that must have just been her clue and cue that it was that she had a friendly audience for what she was about to say. And she proceeded to start to just spew this, the most horrible, horrifying stuff that I've ever heard about Jews and what God was going to do to the Jews because of what they were doing to the Palestinians. And she was quoting some sort of scripture. And it was just, I mean, the content of it was so horrible that I've actually blocked it out for the most part. I can't even remember a lot of what she said because I was just getting nauseous. And you have to understand what had just happened in that region of the world at this moment was that there had been a battle between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian gunmen in Israel-Palestine. And you may have seen the footage of this. There was a little boy with his father in front of this stone wall between the gunfire, and the Israelis were here and the Palestinians were behind them. And the father was wounded, but he was trying to shield his little boy from the bullets. And the Israeli soldiers shot and killed the little boy. And this whole thing was caught in just excruciating detail on this videotape. And that videotape had been shown, we didn't see it a lot here, we saw some of it, but in the Arab world, it had been played like 1,000 times. So she was talking about that, and she was that was fueling her rage. So my initial reaction, my human self, wanted to get the heck away from her. I was just like, oh, this is horrible. You know, I was shaking, it was so bad. And then I thought, you know, I can't affect any change if I walk away from this girl. And all I'm going to do if I do that is confirm what she already knows, which is Americans are, you know, they are always with Israel and they don't listen to us. And so that was my first reaction, and I talked myself out of walking away. The second reaction was, what if somebody in my group actually hears me listen, you know, hears what she's saying and sees me talking to her, and are they going to think I agree? And so I had to kind of work through that one to get to sit there. And as she talked, I'm sure that my face reflected the despair that I felt with what she was saying. And she finally kind of looked at me and she said, her face changed a little, and she said, I bet what I'm saying sounds strange to you. And I just looked at her and I said, sweetie, strange isn't the word that I would use for what you're saying to me. And I said, it's just really disturbing. And I said, you know, I have lots of friends who are Jews, and you're talking about people I love and care about, and they're people that would never harm you or anyone you know. And I said, I understand your feelings of rage about what's happening to the Palestinians and what happened to little Mohammed Dura. I don't agree with what's going on. I think no child should ever die the way that little boy died. It just breaks my heart. But that's not the answer. And the God I believe in, because she was quoting some kind of scripture, I said, the God I believe in wouldn't allow that either, you know, would not create what you're saying. So then she kind of looked at me and she said, well, what religion are you anyway? And I'm very careful about answering that question there because I like to maintain a level of neutrality. I don't want anybody to think I'm promoting an agenda. So I told her my interfaith spiel and I said, you know, I think Islam is a beautiful religion, and Judaism and Christianity and Hinduism. And she said, Hinduism? Is that the one where they worship cows? So we had a little comparative religion lesson for a few minutes. And then before long, we were talking about what it's like for her as a 16-year-old girl in a very conservative culture with a father who wants things to stay the same. And it was a conversation I would have with a teenage girl pretty much anywhere in the world. and she liked me. So did I change her opinions about Jews? Did I, you know, miraculously replace her belief system? No, I'm sure that I didn't. She was spewing what she'd heard. You could just see it wasn't her own thinking. It was just what she's been taught. But she didn't like Americans when we started. She made that very clear, that she did not like Americans and what I said before. And by the end, I know she liked me. So there was one American that she knows that didn't put her down for her beliefs. I made it clear I didn't agree with them and that that wasn't my way of thinking. So I feel like I did what I could do in that situation, and I'm glad I didn't walk away from her. My other story happens closer to home in Reno, Nevada, and I was actually, have a little admission here, I was in a poker bar playing video poker, because that's a hobby of mine. And there was a guy that was the musician. He was really good on stage, and he was playing rock and roll, which I like. And I'd been there for a couple hours listening to him, and his music was great, and his voice was great. And then he said, "Now I'm going to sing a patriotic song for you." And I was like, I just knew. I was like, uh-oh. I just had this bad feeling. And I was there with a friend, and I was like, oh, you know, I hope this doesn't go somewhere bad. And he proceeded to start singing this song about being on an airplane, and these two Arabs get on, and so it's full of all this derogatory, stereotypical racist stuff, you know, the smell and their voices, and their, he got some cultures mixed up and was talking about what they were wearing on their heads, and he wasn't right. And and I just sat there and I thought, oh, I've got to do my thing. And I'm like in this bar full of people who probably aren't going to be terribly sympathetic with my viewpoint. And I've got this friend here who didn't sign up to do my thing with me. So, you know, it could get dangerous. And how's he going to feel about that? But I had to do it. So I thought, well, how can I do this? You know, I don't want to publicly humiliate this guy. That's part of the deal. So I just started. I'd been making a lot of eye contact and really into his music. And so I stopped that. And I just kind of started shaking my head. You know, just when he'd say the worst lines, I would shake my head. And then I'd look up at him. And every once in a while, he'd look at me. And he was shocked. I mean, he was just, like, disturbed at my reaction. And it went on. And when the song finished, he came over to the edge of the stage. And he said, he put away his mic. And he said, I can't help but notice you really didn't like my song. And I said, no, I didn't care for your song. And he's like, well, do you mind telling me why? And I said, well, it was incredibly racist. No, it was funny. I said, I can believe that you intended for it to be funny, but I said it was really racist. And then I said, you know, the way that they smell and what's going to happen to them if they so much as, like, look funny at anybody. And, you know, and I said, you know, we just have enough hatred and distrust in the world. And I said, you know, I have a lot of Arab friends, and all I can do is imagine how they'd feel if they were sitting here with me. Of course, they wouldn't be gambling and drinking, but if they were sitting here with me and had heard your song, you know, it would have hurt them. And so it hurts me for them. And I said, it just really hurts me. So he said, I want to talk to you more about this. And so on his break, after he finished his set, he came and sat with me. And my friend was very proud of what I did. And so he came and sat with me, and we had a long discussion about it. And in the end, he said, you know, other people have reacted badly to that song before and just left. But he's like, but honestly, I didn't know why. I didn't understand how it was coming across. He said, I thought it was funny, and I just thought they didn't have senses of humor. But he said, now I understand. And he said, I won't ever sing that song again. So, you know, I like this line out of the Jewel song, Life Uncommon, which is, there are plenty of people who pray for peace, but if praying were enough, it would have come to be. And it's pretty easy to be peaceful while we're sitting at home, meditating in our recliner, you know, the cat on our lap. But when we get out there in the world and rub up against each other in the arena of life, it's much, much more difficult. And that's where it counts the most, because as we know, faith without works is dead. You know, just sitting at home and not taking it out there doesn't really shift things as fast as it could. So Jesus, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, all these people took it to the streets. They didn't just sit in the cave and meditate. And they went into the troubled places of this world and set a different example of what was possible. And we can all do that in our own corner of life. And so, as we conclude here today, we recognize that we all have a part to play in the healing of our troubled world. Each and every time we testify to love or come from our true nature or do our thing,
It's like dropping a quarter in a change bucket. Each and every time we respond by turning the other cheek, we drop another quarter into this bucket of change. And as we do that, others are free to do that as well. They drop more quarters into the bucket until one day that bucket of change overflows and creates a massive change in consciousness and a peaceful planet. We all have to do our own healing work and our spiritual growth work and work simultaneously to show up differently in the world in our daily lives in order to bring about this radical transformation. We can't stay in the cave meditating and wait. We need to get out there. It isn't about waiting for them over there, wherever that is, to get it right. So some of us, like me, are called to actually go into those hot spots and do interventions almost over there, to be there, work there. But others are asked to do that right from their home base, wherever you sit, because every bit of it counts. It all matters. There is no us and them. We're all one and connected. So each one of you, you may already know what your thing is, but each one of you has to find your own way, your own unique way, because you were created for that, to put that love out into the world. And whatever your particular version is, it's just important to find it, know it, and do it every day. So I want to leave you with a couple thoughts, quotes that I really like. And John F. Kennedy said this, "Peace is a daily, a weekly, a monthly process, gradually changing opinions, slowly eroding barriers, and quietly building new structures." And then we've all heard this very powerful thought from Mahatma Gandhi, which is, be the change that you want to see in the world. And when we each take our love out into the world in our own way, that's exactly what we're doing. We're using our little ice pick, and we're working for the good of all. We are the change that we seek, and we can literally change the songs that people sing out there. So please remember to pick up your little handout when you leave on the back table. They're going to be back there and give you a little bit more information. And may we truly have peace on this earth, and may it begin with each one of us here today.